2.2 that shows the names of the enzymes, pepsin, trypsin, chymotrypsin, elastase, and carboxypeptidases. Those are plural because there's carboxypeptidase A and carboxypeptidase B. A couple of carboxypeptidases that they have in mind there. And these enzymes I would classify as proteases because they break bonds and proteins. They catalyze hydrolysis of bonds and proteins. Or as a synonym for proteases, peptidases, because they break peptide bonds. So be willing to hear these enzymes called either proteases or peptidases. And both of those designations refer to their ability to catalyze hydrolysis of peptide bonds and proteins. Looks like the first thing that needs to happen is for pepsinogen to turn into pepsin. And then pepsin will be the first active enzyme involved in the hydrolysis of your dietary protein. Pepsinogen turning into pepsin is something I want you to have a bit of understanding about. It looks like acid helps. Here's a proton. So an acidic environment helps with that conversion of pepsinogen into pepsin. The pepsinogen, in fact, all of these over here in the left-hand column, is an example of a proenzyme or zymogen. Those are synonyms. I think you need to know both terms. They're used so often. Proenzyme or zymogen. Either one of those designations would indicate something that's not yet an active enzyme. And what's required for it to become an active enzyme is for it to lose a part of itself and to become something smaller, but then it'll have the right shape to be an active enzyme. Now, for the precursor form, the proenzyme or zymogen that's not yet active, realize that there are peptide bonds. It's a protein. And what we're really talking about is breaking one or more of those peptide bonds in the proenzyme or zymogen form. Proteolysis, proteolysis, to say it slowly, proteolysis, or proteolysis is how it's often pronounced. Would be the process of breaking those peptide bonds. Proteolysis just says lysis of protein. And when it leads to activation of an enzyme, when the proteolysis, represented by the arrows going left to right, leads to an active enzyme, you might speak of that process as proteolytic activation. You've made it active. By proteolysis, you have turned it into something smaller, but now it's active. Proteolytic activation. That's what any zymogen or proenzyme requires before it will be an active enzyme, is it requires proteolytic activation. This arena that we're in now, the digestion of protein, is a great arena to find lots of precursor forms of enzymes, proenzymes or zymogens, in other words, that require proteolytic activation. One other arena that has a lot of this proteolytic activation of enzymes in it is the arena of blood clotting. When you study the blood clotting cascade involving clotting factors, a lot of clotting factors start off in a proenzyme or zymogen form and require proteolytic activation for the clotting cascade. Back to protein digestion, the arena we're actually in now. Let's go back to the picture that's on the same page, showing that it's in the stomach where pepsin forms. And one thing I would want to have you know is where does the pepsinogen that turns into the pepsin come from? Where does the pepsinogen come from? And it comes from some cells in the wall of the stomach. In the gastric pits, you find these cells called chief cells. Chief cells are the cells that make pepsinogen. chief, spelled this way, chief cells. And in that way, what really first appears in the lumen of the stomach is pepsinogen, and it undergoes its proteolytic activation there in the lumen of the stomach. And stomach acid, here it's represented by HCl. Stomach acid is very important in that process. Here it says HCl to indicate that. Here it says H plus to indicate that. The stomach acid is coming from some cells that are also in the gastric pits, or the wall of the stomach would be a simple way to refer to their location. And those cells that make the stomach acid are parietal cells. So I would want you to know who makes the pepsinogen and who makes the stomach acid. But then here's the idea. Once the parietal cells have produced a very acidic environment in the stomach juices, the gastric juice, the pepsinogen will be influenced by that acidic environment to take on a shape where it, I like to say it bites off its own tail. It proteolytically activates itself. It breaks some of its own peptide bonds to shorten itself into pepsin. This is pretty cool. I don't have a lot of examples like this to tell you about, where something activates itself. And all it takes is for pepsinogen, to be in an acidic enough of an environment for it to take on the proper shape to then proteolytically activate itself. That's what they're trying to tell you, I think, with this dotted line right here, is that it's actually the pepsinogen itself that turns pepsinogen into pepsin. Then the pepsin will be a protease or peptidase that helps begin the digestion of your dietary protein. To continue the story of this digestion of dietary protein, we go next to the small intestine. The chief cells. He wants to know what I said about chief cells. Chief cells are the ones that make pepsinogen. The small intestine is going to have some enzymes to help continue this job, thanks to some proenzymes or zymogens that appear in pancreatic juice because they're made by the pancreas. That would be the trypsinogen, chymotrypsinogen, proelastase, procarboxypeptidases A and B. Also mentioned here, trypsinogen, chymotrypsinogen, proelastase, and procarboxypeptidases. All of these zymogens are in the pancreatic juice. They're produced by the pancreas. But then by some ductwork that connects the pancreas to the small intestine, these zymogens go into the small intestine, and when things work properly, it's not until then that these zymogens become activated by proteolytic activation. What sort of gets the ball rolling to turn these pancreatic zymogens into active enzymes is some trypsinogens turning into trypsins first, a sort of a master switch of this part of the digestion story. Trypsinogen turning into trypsin requires, that's proteolytic activation going on, and it requires somebody to break the peptide bonds that need to be broken for trypsinogen to become trypsin. There needs to be some protease or peptidase to catalyze proteolytic activation. And here's the enzyme, the peptidase or protease, that catalyzes trypsinogen breaking in the places it needs to break to become trypsin. It's an enzyme called enteropeptidase, and its location is along the wall of the small intestine, the brush border. It's a brush border enzyme. Enteropeptidase is produced by the wall of the small intestine. Enterocytes would be the cells there that make the enteropeptidase. And then it turns some trypsinogens into trypsins. The trypsins would then be active enzymes And from here, it can all be the first trypsins that turn on the rest of these pancreatic zymogens into active enzyme forms. The very first trypsins to form can turn other trypsinogens into trypsins. So that begins to snowball now, the trypsinogens turning into trypsins. It begins to snowball because the first trypsins made can turn other trypsinogens into trypsins. And the first trypsins made, or all the trypsins made by now, can turn chymotrypsinogens into chymotrypsins, proelastases into elastases, and procarboxypeptidases to carboxypeptidases. I think you've already caught on to how the names reflect what I'm describing. If there's a pro-beginning or an ogen ending, if there's an ogen ending or a pro-beginning, that would indicate a zymogen or proenzyme, same thing. And then what you recall, the active form of the enzyme upon proteolytic activation is the name that's left over if you drop off that pro-beginning or that ogen ending. So trypsinogen becomes trypsin, proelastase becomes elastase. I think the naming works in a fairly logical way. So now we would have all of these in their active enzyme form. The pepsin only does its job in the stomach, and then it'll be the job of the trypsin, chymotrypsin, elastase, and carboxypeptidases to continue the job that we find here for digesting dietary proteins. There's still a couple more enzymes to mention, a few more enzymes to mention. At the brush border, there are some aminopeptidases. Those are brush border enzymes. And the designation aminopeptidase, I want to be one that has some meaning for you. It's time maybe to begin to distinguish between endopeptidases and exopeptidases. This is all part of learning objective 12. Now I'm going to use figure 37.3 from page 689 for a moment. It shows enough of a polypeptide chain here to illustrate some facts about the enzymes that help us digest dietary protein. And the enzymes mentioned at the top and the enzymes mentioned at the bottom are exopeptidases because they specialize in catalyzing the breaking of the very last peptide bond at the end of a polypeptide chain. That's what exopeptidases would catalyze. If it's an exopeptidase that specializes in breaking this peptide bond, in other words, the last peptide bond at the N-terminus or amino-terminus, that would be an aminopeptidase. That enzyme would be an aminopeptidase. And if it's an enzyme that works best at the C-terminus or carboxy-terminus, if it's an exopeptidase that works best at this peptide bond, that's the very last peptide bond at the C-terminus or carboxy-terminus, then that exopeptidase would be a carboxypeptidase. So now I'm hoping you understand aminopeptidases that work at the amino end and carboxypeptidases that work at the carboxy end. Those are the exopeptidases. And we just encountered some aminopeptidases in my discussion of brush border enzymes. We found some aminopeptidases. The pepsin, trypsin, chymotrypsin, and elastase mentioned here have already been a part of this discussion, and I'm starting to gather from what this diagram shows me that all of them, the pepsin, the trypsin, the chymotrypsin, and the elastase, all of them are endopeptidases that can catalyze breaking peptide bonds more within the interior of a polypeptide chain. They don't work just at the ends, they work at peptide bonds all throughout the interior of the polypeptide chain. Here's sort of a simple way to diagram what I'm trying to express to you. If here's a polypeptide chain with an N-terminus and a C-terminus, which would it be? Would it be an endopeptidase or an exopeptidase that could break this polypeptide chain into two roughly equal-sized pieces? Okay, I do think you got it. It would be an endopeptidase that could do that, not an exopeptidase. The other information in this diagram goes beyond what I would hold you responsible for, but what they're showing you is that these various endopeptidases specialize somewhat in which peptide bonds within the interior of the polypeptide chain they catalyze the breaking of best. Here's how it works, and you do not need to learn this information. You don't even know all the amino acids yet, so it would be kind of ridiculous for me to ask you to learn this. But what they're trying to show you here is that pepsin best helps catalyze breaking peptide bonds after these amino acids. And trypsin best catalyzes breaking peptide bonds after these amino acids. And chymotrypsin best catalyzes breaking peptide bonds that follow these amino acids. And elastase best breaks peptide bonds that follow those amino acids. You can see some overlap in the amino acids mentioned in those groups. And I want to back off from detail some right now to have you just realize that even as a team, all these enzymes mentioned thus far do not break the polypeptide chains completely into individual amino acids. There are some peptide bonds left intact. Let's go back to this picture. You see, even after the pepsin, trypsin, chymotrypsin, elastase, and carboxypeptidases, and the brush border aminopeptidases have all had their opportunities to work as part of the team in breaking down the dietary protein, there might still be some pieces that are dipeptide-sized or tripeptide-sized. There would have been a lot of successful breaking it down into individual amino acids already, so a lot of individual amino acids at this point. But let's realize that the dipeptides and tripeptides can be absorbed before all the last peptide bonds are broken. That's what's being indicated by these arrows right here, that not only can individual amino acids be absorbed from the lumen of the gut into this enterocyte, but so can the dipeptide and tripeptide-sized pieces that might still remain at this point. They can enter the enterocytes. So it's not like it was with monosaccharides, with carbohydrates having to get to monosaccharide size. We can absorb some pieces that still have some hydrolyzable bonds in them. Do you understand how big a dipeptide would be and how big a tripeptide would be? It's a little bit tricky, actually. A dipeptide describes something that's two amino acids big. But how many peptide bonds does a dipeptide have? Yeah, that's why I say it's kind of tricky. A dipeptide only has one peptide bond holding two amino acids together. A tripeptide is three amino acids held together by a couple of peptide bonds. Those can be absorbed. And then inside the enterocyte, so intracellularly, there are some dipeptidases and tripeptidases that can, inside the enterocyte, complete the job if you want, breaking those dipeptides and tripeptides into individual amino acids. So inside the enterocytes, we finally get to, now it's all down to amino acid sized. And because amino acids are water-soluble nutrients, they can quite easily leave the basolateral surfaces of enterocytes and diffuse into capillaries in the gut wall and find themselves next in the hepatic portal vein headed to the liver. That might have covered everything in objective... No, it doesn't quite. We're not quite done with objective 12. There's one last sentence to objective 12 about the absorption event going on right here. I want to explain this part right here better, where amino acids leave the lumen of the gut and go into enterocytes of the gut wall. Let's look at figure 37.4. To get a better look at what's happening right here, we're going to go next to figure 37.4. Here's that enterocyte. Here's amino acids in the lumen of the small intestine being absorbed. And it's active absorption of the amino acid made possible by co-absorption, co-transport of sodium from the lumen into the enterocyte. It's a sodium-dependent process that allows active absorption or import of amino acids. They say there's about six such sodium-dependent transporters for amino acids, and they have overlapping specificities for which amino acids they let in best. But it all works pretty well, these six transporters like this one that specialize in different groups of amino acids. Together as a team, they pretty well absorb all the amino acids from the gut, from the lumen of the gut. And here's that terminology we tried to master earlier when we were talking about absorptions of some monosaccharides. Here it is in the caption, secondary active transport. This process is an example of secondary active transport. So here's the sodium-potassium pump playing its part in that process. And because we talked about this kind of a process for glucose, I don't think I need to say all that again. You understand secondary active transport, and we can go on. For objective number 13, I'm going to call up a figure from page 486. Reading from left to right, we're watching time go on, and right here at time zero, the person eats a high-protein meal. I don't think it's any surprise that the blood level of nitrogen goes up after that meal because of the amino acids. They have nitrogen, and the amino acids appearing in the bloodstream after this meal. What about the glucose level? Stays pretty flat. Let's have this be such a high protein meal that it's pure protein. Let's keep it simple. A pure protein meal. The glucose level doesn't change. Even though you didn't have any carbohydrate in that meal. And you might ask yourself, how is the person's body maintaining a steady, unchanging blood sugar level? If you didn't eat any sugar, why isn't that blood sugar level falling? What's maintaining the blood sugar level? think I heard some of you say the answer, but I'm going to make you wait a little bit more before I say it. The insulin level. So now we're talking about some hormone levels, insulin and glucagon. The insulin level evidently goes up some after a pure protein meal. And a reason that would be is that glucose is not the only thing that stimulates beta cells of the pancreas to release insulin. From page 485, we've got this nice little table for things that affect insulin release from the beta cells. And these two are ones I really want you to know. Glucose is the major regulator of that release of insulin, and glucose causes an increased release of insulin. But amino acids deserves mention here as well. So think about, we just ate a high protein meal and the amino acid level in the blood rising, and some of those amino acids now stimulating the beta cells of the pancreas to release more insulin. Amino acids increase insulin release. That would be why I'd say the insulin level goes up some after this meal that's pure protein. The advantage to having the insulin level rise after a high protein meal, as I see it, is that insulin will stimulate cells throughout the body to take in amino acids from the blood, amino acids that came from the meal that you ate. Now, cells will be able to use those amino acids because insulin makes them better at taking in amino acids from the blood. Like, what if you, between meals, broke down some of your muscle protein? Now's the time to rebuild that muscle protein. You just ate a high-protein meal, and now would be a great time to rebuild your muscle protein that was broken down while you were fasting between meals. But insulin's going to help this process by making muscle cells better at taking in amino acids from the blood after this meal. And then also, insulin kind of in general stimulates protein synthesis in the body. And so insulin would in that way encourage muscle cells to replace the muscle protein that they broke down in the fasting state. Insulin stimulates building projects in general. Protein synthesis is one that I just mentioned that would be stimulated by insulin.
So how does the insulin
Yes, she has concluded correctly that the way insulin makes muscle cells better at taking in amino acids from the blood is by having the muscle cells increase their number of transporters for amino acids in the muscle cell membranes. But now let's look at glucagon after this question.
And they're the same transporters that bring in.
She's asking now, would the transporters for bringing glucose in from the blood into muscle cells be the same kinds of doorways? No, that's not what you're asking.
No, it is, but I'm thinking that that's probably not.
And you're correct. She has correctly answered her own question now, where she has decided that the doorways that muscle cells use for letting amino acids in from the blood are different than the sodium-dependent doorways that we saw for absorption from the gut. They're not sodium-dependent, for example. The doorways that allow muscle cells to take in amino acids from the blood are not sodium-dependent doorways. What are they? Amino acid transporters, just a general term for these doorways that the muscle cells would have increasingly, thanks to insulin, I'm just going to call them amino acid transporters.
I have a question. So when we're talking about the lumen, then it is sodium dependent, but when we're talking about muscles, then it's not?
When we're talking about enterocytes absorbing from the lumen of the gut, that's the sodium dependent transporters. Yes. Glucagon. Yeah, let's look at the glucagon level. Glucagon comes from some cells in the pancreas, side by side with beta cells, called alpha cells, the alpha cells in the pancreas. They're in the islets of Langerhans, just like beta cells are. Alpha cells of the pancreas make glucagon. Glucagon is a polypeptide and is secreted by alpha cells. And the level of glucagon in the person's blood after the high-protein meal goes up dramatically. Let's remember what we saw about these hormones after a high-carbohydrate meal. After a high-carbohydrate meal, we saw the insulin level go way up and the glucagon level go way down. And we made sense out of that. Well, I want to make sense out of this as well. They both go up after the insulin level and the glucagon level both go up after this high-protein meal. The insulin level goes up a little. It doesn't go up nearly as much as it does after the high-carbohydrate meal. But it goes up a little to stimulate, well, I was mentioning, the intake of amino acids and protein synthesis. The glucagon going up at this point is going to help the person maintain their blood sugar level because glucagon stimulates gluconeogenesis in the liver cells. And it may be that gluconeogenesis is the only process by which this person can maintain their blood sugar level after this meal. Maybe it's been so long since the previous meal that they're out of liver glycogen. If that is the case, if they're out of liver glycogen, then gluconeogenesis is the only process left in a person's body to maintain the blood sugar level. And if you just ate a high-protein meal that was pure protein, didn't have any carbohydrate in it, boy, is it going to be important that your body be able to do gluconeogenesis, just as important as it is in the fasting state. You just ate, but if you ate pure protein, gluconeogenesis remains just as important as it was in the fasting state. You don't have to break down your muscle protein right now to supply amino acids for gluconeogenesis because you just ate a high-protein meal, and you can use those amino acids. But to encourage the liver to continue gluconeogenesis using amino acids from the meal, the glucagon level rising makes good sense. Glucagon will stimulate gluconeogenesis, and that is quite important.
And that's the same pathway, no matter where your amino acids are coming from. For the liver, it doesn't really matter whether it's coming from your diet or from your muscle cells, as long as it's getting amino acids.
Yes, she's realizing that a liver cell would use amino acids for gluconeogenesis without even really knowing where they came from. Did they come from muscle cells or did they come from a meal? To a liver cell, the amino acid is usable for gluconeogenesis regardless of where it came from. Same pathway. Her question was, would glucagon levels rise in the fasting state? And the answer is yes. But here's why the glucagon level might rise an extra amount after this high-protein meal. From page 486, there's a table for the regulators of glucagon release. And I really want you to know all three of these. I starred the one that I'm making a big deal about right now after this high-protein meal. Amino acids from the high-protein meal would stimulate the alpha cells of the pancreas to release glucagon. Amino acids are the only thing mentioned in this table that stimulate the alpha cells of the pancreas to release glucagon. Now, for why glucagon level would rise in the fasting state, someone just asked about that. I might look at these things, glucose and insulin levels in the blood inhibit. In other words, the higher the glucose level or the higher the insulin level in the blood, the more inhibition there would be of the release of glucagon from alpha cells of the pancreas. So, in the fasting state, the levels of these things, glucose and insulin, tend to fall, and that would be less inhibition then. When the levels of glucose and insulin fall, as you go into the fasting state between meals, there would be then less inhibition of the alpha cells of the pancreas, and their release of glucagon would increase. I want you to know all three of these regulators of glucagon release and the directions of their influences on glucagon release. For the fates of amino acids in the fed state, learning objective number 14, I'm going to take you to a picture on page 698. Page 698. This picture right here. So here's the amino acids after digestion and absorption, perhaps some intracellular breaking of peptide bonds to make it the amino acids, individual amino acids coming out of the gut wall, and then via the hepatic portal vein arriving at the liver, and it's in the liver that they really give me a good idea of some of the uses of amino acids. Here it's telling me that cells throughout the body would be taking in amino acids after this meal and using them to build proteins. That's all stimulated by insulin. But I want to look at what's going on in the liver cell here. And here's an indication that the amino acids can be used as fuel. After a pure protein meal, yeah, I do think that a lot of cells in the body, including liver cells, would be using amino acids as fuel. You just got a lot of this fuel from your meal, and now would be a good time to use it. So here's an indication of using amino acids for fuel. Now, I wish they had shown something about making ATP in that arrow, or maybe show carbon dioxide plus energy coming out of that arrow somehow. Because it's not that the cell needed carbon dioxide, it's that the cell needed energy. That's why it oxidized the amino acids as fuel. Using amino acids for protein synthesis makes sense. Amino acids are the building blocks for proteins. Using amino acids to build other nitrogen-containing compounds, meaning other than proteins, some nitrogen-containing compounds from amino acids. Good examples there would be making heme or making nucleotides. We looked at nucleotides pretty carefully together already, and so you know there's nitrogens in the nucleotide. What about heme? Have you ever looked at heme? I'll make sure we do that at some point, and that you notice the nitrogens when we do. So heme and nucleotides, like the purine and pyrimidine parts of nucleotides, are nitrogen-containing things that would be made from amino acids. Now, down here in the bottom of the liver, I see some projects where the nitrogens are no longer needed. For example, here's gluconeogenesis, amino acids being used to make glucose. Gluconeogenesis in the liver, being shown right there. But there's no nitrogen left in the glucose, so what happened to the nitrogen? I'm going to make you wonder for a second, what happened to the nitrogen? The glucose might be shipped out into the blood to maintain blood sugar. Remember, the blood sugar level stayed nice and flat after this meal? So some of the glucose is maintaining blood sugar. But now is also a good time to fill up the glycogen stores in the liver, and the glucose made from amino acids can be used to replenish the glycogen stores. So both of those things would be going on, using the glucose for blood sugar and for replenishing glycogen stores. But what happened to the nitrogens from the amino acids? Well, before I answer that, let's find this arrow as well, where amino acids are used to make triacylglycerols. If there's enough amino acids after a pure protein meal, that's going to be happening too. With some of the excess amino acids, your liver will be making some fat molecules. Can you end up storing fat even though you didn't eat any fat? All you ate was protein. Yes, you can. These fat molecules are going to be shipped out rather than kept inside the liver. And you already know about very low-density lipoproteins as the way that liver cells export the fat that they make. But what happened to the nitrogen? The triacylglycerols don't have any nitrogen anymore. Well, don't worry about the nitrogen, I want to tell you. The liver cell knows what to do with nitrogen. When the liver cell needs to take nitrogen off of amino acids so that the carbons can be used for other things, the nitrogens are turned into nitrogens of urea. The urea cycle is a pathway, a biochemical pathway that liver cells excel at. In fact, they're the only kinds of cells in your body that can do the urea cycle. Your liver knows what to do with nitrogen. It'll turn nitrogen into nitrogen of urea. And I think we're out of time today. I didn't really get to introduce the fasting state, but I hope that you'll preview the fasting state before Tuesday.
Thank you.